The tech industry at the turn of the century was scrappy, innovative and optimistic. In fact, the mantra of Google's co-founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page, both of whom announced their retirement earlier this week, it was quite simply, don't be evil. Well, 20 years on, we live in a world where the irony of this slogan could not be starker. Big tech harvests our data. It dominates our lives in more ways than we might realise. And as my first guest this hour predicts, could be driving us towards the next financial crash. How did the tech giants become the new too-big-to-fail institutions? Rana Faruha is the Financial Times global business correspondent and the author of a marvellous new book, aptly titled, Don't Be Evil. She joined me earlier from New York and I welcomed her to Saturday Extra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Basic question, why write this book now?
Well, so many reasons. You know, I started the book in 2017. I had just started my job as the global business columnist at the Financial Times. And, you know, when I take on a big job like that, I like to try and narrow the funnel of topics by following the money and seeing, you know, sort of where are money and power in the global economy. And when I began to study that, I quickly realized that pretty much all of it in the last 10, 20 years had flowed into Silicon Valley. So here's a statistic that's kind of mind-boggling. 80% of corporate wealth today is living in the top 10% of companies that control the most personal data and intellectual property. And the biggest of those are the FANG companies, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, and so on. So that was point number one. Point number two, of course, motivating me was the election results of 2016, the issues we've seen globally about disinformation online leading to really terrible outcomes. I mean, the monetization of videos of massacres in Christchurch and so on and so forth. But finally, I had a very personal experience that kind of really galvanized me to write the book, and that's that I came home one day in 2017, I opened up a credit card bill, and I started going through it and noticing all these tiny little charges in increments of $1.99, $3, $5, and I tallied them all up, and I realized that they were from the App Store. And it was over $900 in charges. And I thought, my gosh, have I been hacked? You know, who else has my password? And then I realized my son, my 10-year-old son, had it. Well, subsequent interviews with him showed that he had become completely addicted to an online soccer game. And these games are given away for free, but you're then sort of pulled down this rabbit hole to spend money on in-app purchases. And this is an entire field of behavioral manipulation called captology. And it's very much a part of all the apps and the online technologies we're using daily. And so I thought altogether, this was an economic, political, social story that was really the biggest one I could think of.
Is there seriously something called captology?
There is. Oh, yes. It sounds very Orwellian, but it's an industry. It was actually born out of something even more Orwellian sounding called the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab. And, you know, these technologies basically take some of the things that most of us have heard of, behavioral psychology techniques like, you remember perhaps B.F. Skinner using a clicker button to make dogs salivate with intermittent rewards. But these are really put on steroids by the fact that the digital giants can monitor our behaviors and collect data on us and then use that data to amplify these existing techniques within the apps and within the social media and the search functions that we're all using on a daily basis.
Now, just some clarification, because when you say Silicon Valley, you mean the new Silicon Valley, don't you? And that which is almost like the new Wall Street.
Yeah, that's actually a really important distinction, and that's absolutely right. Basically, I'm charting the rise of, you know, what some like Tim Wu at Columbia have called the attention merchants, the big platform technology companies that since the mid-1990s onwards have basically been all about tracking us and then selling us targeted advertising. So I'm not really talking about the chip makers or the handset makers or the people that kind of invented the Valley. And by the way, it's important to say that a lot of the initial innovations that these companies have built on, things like the internet or GPS or touchscreen technology, were actually government innovations. A lot of these things came out of the U.S. Defense Department. But these attention merchants, over the last 20 years, their big innovation was that people can be monitored and tracked, and advertisers want to sell things when they can section us out to an individual and know exactly what we want and when we might want it.
Now, you believe big tech to be the next big banks. What parallels have you found between the two?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, so much money and power has flowed to these companies. So in the last 10 years or so, they have become the largest offshorers of corporate profits. So they keep a lot of their profits, which are just crescent. I mean, Apple, for example, has about $300 billion on the corporate balance sheets. It's, you know, 10% of America's liquid corporate wealth. Until quite recently, the Trump tax cuts encouraged them to bring some of that money home, but much of it went straight into share buybacks. And that means when a company uses its own money to buy its own shares and thus sort of artificially props up the price of those shares. There have been a record number of share buybacks done in the last couple of years. Many of these companies, in this incredibly Kafkaesque move, have offshored profits yet issued debt in the U.S., corporate debt, in order to pay for those buybacks. It's kind of this weird shell game of money. And what this has meant is that we have both record asset prices, but also a record corporate debt bubble.
Now, because I've really struggled to understand this. The business about share buybacks, in effect, often that becomes a very circular thing, doesn't it? That a lot of the executives' pay structures are related to the share price. So that becomes almost like a pay rise for them, doesn't it, on cheap money?
Yes, exactly. And it's really an artificial rise. You know, we have this idea, and this goes to a deeper question about capitalism and, you know, how we want to restructure it to be more inclusive. We've had this idea in the last 40 years that the share price of a company is a measure of its success. Well, no, it isn't. It's simply a measure of an artificial idea within the market, and that idea can be manipulated. So a company can buy back its shares, raise the share price. That's great for the executives that are getting between, say, 20 and 80% of their compensation in stock. Of course they want to do that. But it doesn't really change the story on the ground. It doesn't mean that there's some new product being invented or a new factory being built.
And the other aspect of this, which I suppose you believe makes it similar to the big banks with all of those complex instruments before the financial crash in 2008, is that a lot of the money that they have, you say 10% of companies control 80% of the $1 trillion in corporate savings parked in offshore accounts, most of that money being held in bonds, corporate bonds. Now, what do we need to understand about that and why you think that is really a dangerous outcome?
Well, so a lot of people are asking at this moment in time, where is the next financial crisis going to come from? And the truth is, it probably won't come from the big banks, because regulation following the financial crisis required them to get a lot of risky things off their balance sheets. Well, risk has transferred to the corporate sector, so there's now a record corporate debt bubble. So those bonds are part of this corporate debt bubble, which if you start to see a slowdown, if you start to see more political tremors, another beat in the U.S.-China conflict, problems in the Middle East, you could start to see that bubble begin to crack. And at that point, the markets are going to correct, and it's a correction that's going to be, I think, led by the tech sector.
And the fact that then it's not held in cash, because that's what I think is a bit confusing, then it's not just parked money, it's in bonds. So someone else is holding the risk effectively. Is that right?
That's right. And that's, you know, it's quite similar to the 2008 crisis in the sense that you probably remember that there were stories about hidden risk, opaque risk, kind of ricocheting from Iowa to Iceland and back. Well, that's the exact same situation you've got here. We don't know who's holding what bonds, where, what the quality of these companies are, but a lot of them are sitting on the balance sheet of the big tech companies. And those companies, interestingly, are even more loosely regulated than banks themselves. But there's also the fact that the environment for the tech companies themselves themselves, which have led the market up, is changing. So their valuations, their share prices are predicated on two things: loose regulation, meaning that we allow them to surveil us, to track us, to sell us products without sort of declaring exactly how or what they're doing, and also the ability to cross borders. And both of those things are changing. I mean, you know, as I'm sure you well know, in Australia, there's now sort of a regionalization of the internet. China is going one way, Europe is going another way, the U.S. is going a third way. I think when the markets finally kind of begin to grapple with this and realize that we don't have globalization as it used to exist anymore, that these share prices will be some of the first to correct.
Mm. Rana Faruha is my guest. She works for the Financial Times as a global business correspondent, but she's brought out a book called Don't Be Evil, which is most definitely making waves around the world. Now, these companies have come to be in this dominant position by harnessing and exploiting their natural monopoly power. Now, people like Martin Wolf are writing about this too. Mm-hmm. This is really distorting, isn't it, the way in which we've imagined markets work in market economies?
Yes, absolutely. So if you think about, let's go back way back to Adam Smith, the father of modern capitalism. He would have said that you needed three things in order for a market to function properly. You need equal access to data. You need transparency on both sides of a transaction. So you and I should understand what is being bought or sold in the same way. And you need a shared moral framework. Now, you can argue that when you are doing something on Facebook or Google, there's none of that in effect because, first of all, you're not paying in dollars, you're paying in data. So there's complete opacity in the transaction. You don't know how much your data is worth to them, but you can bet that they know, and they can sell it to the highest advertising bidder. All of this is very opaque, and so the usual laws of economic gravity really stop working with these companies. Mm-hmm. And this power, along with what's called the network effect, which is their ability to grow exponentially. You know, the more Facebook users there are, the bigger Facebook gets, and then that allows them to grow to very large sizes and exert monopoly power.
Mm. I mean, there's all sorts of people writing, and people at the Roosevelt Institute saying markets are now more concentrated and less competitive than at any point since the Gilded Age. And what you're describing, isn't that essentially anti-competitive behaviours? So why haven't they been treated as monopolies by the US government and broken up or at least constrained by the threat of regulation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're really putting your finger on the main question. And the reason for this is that the way we think about monopoly power traditionally is just completely ill-suited to thinking about these companies. So let me give you an example. Since the 1980s, the sort of ethos in the U.S., which has been copied in many other parts of the world, is that as long as consumer prices are falling, then there's no problem. It doesn't matter how big a company gets. You can have a company like Walmart, for example, old bricks and mortar retailer, coming into little towns and driving out local businesses. And all right, we don't think that's a problem because prices are going down. Well, suddenly, you have this group of firms that really don't deal in prices. They deal in data. And in fact, many of the things that they're giving us are free. And I put free in quotation marks because, again, we are paying. We're paying with our data. But it makes it very, very difficult to build an antitrust case against the companies. That said, you are starting to see regulators in the U.S., but also particularly in Europe, where I think the efforts have been more aggressive, saying, all right, we really do need to look more carefully and perhaps come up with some new ways of gauging monopoly power.
Well, this is where the Democrat primaries are going to be so interesting, isn't it? Because the presidential candidate, Elizabeth Warren, is advocating for the breakup of these tech firms. Is it possible that they are already lobbying against her, like she was soaring earlier this year and she's plateaued a bit, because their lobbying efforts, if I can segue to that, are really extraordinary, aren't they? They're the second largest lobby group in Washington, D.C., right behind Big Pharma.
Well, that's absolutely right. Google and Amazon alone are the two biggest corporate lobbyists. But, you know, there's something even more insidious here, in a way. There's the money that we can see, and that has become huge, as you say. But there's also the influence that we can't see. I mean, one of the things that is truly unique about these firms, and in fact, this is a topic of a column that I'm working on right now, is the fact that We don't know what goes on in the algorithmic black box. You know, they can shift our behaviors. They can shift our purchasing decisions. They can, you know, shift our mood, as was, you know, famously reported with the case in Australia involving Facebook trialing advertising and messaging towards depressed teenagers. They can do all this. And so could they swing elections? Maybe.
Well, what I found quite interesting in your book is the idea about the politics of all of this, and really thinking in a more tangential way, I suppose, that often the titans of big tech are accused of being disproportionately liberal, we'd say sort of the left here in Australia. In fact, you say they're really more libertarian. Can you explain why you think this is the case and why that matters?
Well, you can simply look at the donation patterns. I mean, someone like Eric Schmidt, who was the former CEO and chair of Google and then Alphabet, major tech titan, he gives pretty much equally to both the Democrat and Republican parties. You have others like Peter Thiel, for example, the head of Palantir, who wants California to secede from the union. You have Mark Zuckerberg taking secret meetings with President Trump. So the bottom line is that these folks are very sharp-elbowed business people, and they will work with whichever politicians they think will best serve their goals.
But there's also a sort of sense there that you describe. They have a little bit of a sort of only mugs stay behind, you know, a very much a 80s style greed is good. And they don't believe in government. They think government is there as a part of a problem. Now, this is not, I don't think, the generalized view of those tech companies.
Well, no, that's very true. And it kind of gets the difference between social values and economic values. I mean, socially...
It's a bit sort of Ayn Rand libertarianism, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. It's more about, exactly as you say, government isn't really good for anything but cutting taxes and it should just get out of the way. And we should be able to disrupt whatever we want and not ask, you know, move fast and break things. That's the ethos.
Okay, so if we do start to understand all this, do we need another Teddy Roosevelt to break them up? I mean, what do you think leaders can do? What do you think citizens can do?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I would encourage everyone just as individuals to try a digital detox, you know, try going offline. And if nothing else, it will give you a sense of what a powerful force these companies are in your life, because they have become as necessary as utilities, as water or electricity. They have a tremendous amount of power over us, cognitively, economically, and politically. In terms of what regulators can do, I do think that we are going to see regulation coming down the pike in a variety of ways. One thing I think we'll see sooner rather than later is some enforcement of rules that actually already exist, separating networks and commerce. So if you go back, again, as you say, to Teddy Roosevelt or Louis Brandeis, who was the big judicial reformer who helped curb the railroad titans, there was a sense that, all right, you can own the network, you can own the railroad, let's say, but you can't own the cars that run on it and everything in the cars, the grain, the coal, et cetera. I think that that is the model we should follow with a company like Amazon, for example. And indeed, it is the model that we follow in banking, that banks can trade, but they can't own every single bit of the aluminum or the coal or the gas that's on the platforms. But today, Amazon can be essentially the global marketplace outside of China for e-commerce, and they can also compete against their own customers selling their own products, and they can perhaps direct all of us to the products and services that they want us to buy. And that is patently uncompetitive.
Yes, you suggest something like a digital New Deal and, what is interesting, a digital Food and Drug Administration, you know, but modelled on the US Food and Drug Administration, which is a grand old institution designed to almost be there to support American wellness, if I can summarise it to that. Now, what are you getting at there?
Well, I'm getting at the fact that we're going to need entire regulatory overhaul, similar to what we had during the Industrial Revolution or during the turn of the century with the rise of the, you know, moving from an agricultural to an industrial society. We are in the midst of essentially what is a new industrial revolution. It's a digital revolution. Our entire economy is digitizing. All of the things we've just been talking about within the space of the consumer internet are coming into the Internet of Things. They're coming into new industries, into finance, into healthcare. There are now sensors in many cities that can track our movements and layer all this data together. And so this is going to be a multi-decade shift. It's going to have profound effects. Some of those effects could be quite disturbing. Again, I'll mention China and say that, you know, in China, you don't have a privacy debate. You have a surveillance debate and a system of social credits in which if people are doing right-thinking things by the government's lights, they maybe find it easier to get an apartment or a job. And if they're not, then the opposite would be true. Do we want to have an internet like that? Do we want to have an economy like that? These are the value judgments that we need to start making as a society.
Well, Rana, plenty to think about to take over our Christmas break. Thank you very much. Just when we thought it was safe to emerge. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Rana Faruha is the Financial Times Global Business Correspondent, the author of Don't Be Evil. It's published by Penguin Random House.